feeling quite hungover though, so that's why I've got the sexy morning voice on.
Sexy?
Yeah. It's all relative.
We are recording, please go ahead.
Hello and welcome to episode 82 of the Rights Rumble podcast. This is not the second time that we're recording the introduction.
You don't need to tell them. They wouldn't have known.
I think most...
You're insufferable. You're just making me look incompetent.
Well, you are incompetent. I want people to know that you don't understand technology.
That I'm the problem. Yeah, and I've chosen this fucking career.
Yeah, yeah. I want the people to have an honest impression of you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, yeah. Mate.
Anyway, I'm Jimmy, and as per usual, and as you can hear, I'm joined by Jazza. Jazza, how are you?
Glorious, fantastic, in the superlative. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And
Apart from hungover.
And we're joined by a special guest who's hopefully not hungover, Rowan from the pool.
Hello. I'm not
Can you have that as your actual name now? Rowan from the pool.
Yeah, that's... I'm contractually obliged to have that as part of my legal name now.
Yeah. Can you introduce yourself for people who may not have heard you or know of you before?
Sure. My name's Rowan Ellis. I make videos on YouTube. Not Vimeo. I like it. Where else is it going to make them?
Daily Motion. It's booming.
Jesus. But essentially about activism and pop culture from a queer and feminist lens. And I'm also the social media manager of The Pool, which is an online website. Rowan, what are you doing? That was redundant.
One of those online websites.
Those online websites. Yeah, basically it's a website aimed at women, which it works like a TV channel or a radio station in that it has drops at particular times of day, depending on what research shows women in the UK would be doing at that point, what they'd be interested in. So politics for the commute, going through, there's beauty and fashion at the lunch break, and then onto recipes, kind of opinion pieces, stuff like that later on.
I don't read politics on the commute. It just depresses me.
Yeah, why is it that they prefer to have...
You know, as a spokesperson for all of the women...
Can you explain? Because you said it's based on like market research and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I say politics. It's kind of like the news drop and stuff that's happening at the top of the day. We have a news drop on from...
I love that you're calling it a news drop.
Yeah, well. That's like what we call
it's
it
like drop
well.
The beat.
Yeah, keep going, Jasmine. Yeah, so we actually, yeah, most of our stuff comes in the morning on the commute or in the evening, which is kind of interesting to know. For me. For you guys.
For you, specifically.
Specifically for me. It's like, post it on Facebook at 7 a.m, Rowan.
What are we talking about today, Jimmy?
So we're starting off talking about the attacks in Manchester, the attack in Manchester that occurred at the Ariana Grande concert.
Ariana Grande. I like Ariana Grande so much. I want an Ariana Venti.
Very good.
Shouldn't really be
that
doing
was a,
jokes.
That was a Starbucks related joke.
Yeah, thanks. It was also stolen from Alaska Thunderfuck, who's a drag queen. Anyway. quite seriously, quite a lot of people died. Second largest death toll from a terrorist attack outside of 7/7.
I'm trying to think the Lockerbie attacks. Quite a few people died in that as well.
Well,
I'm not sure if it's the second.
Well, it isn't a competition.
Yeah.
Lots of people tragically lost their lives. And we'll be talking about the media fallout of this. And also the what we know about the bomber. And the implications of this for us.
Mm.
Also, Trump is sharing secrets about what we're investigating.
I thought you were going to say Trump is sharing his feelings about things.
The losers.
I mean, he does. Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Well, they are losers. That was something we could agree on.
Mm.
Anyway, second topic.
Second topic. Andrew Neil interviewed... he's interviewing all of the party leaders over the course of the past week.
All of
the
big
week.
Five,
the big five.
Say. The raving monster loony party are not included. Nor are the pirates who were on a couple of weeks ago.
Indeed, yeah. We could probably get the monster raving loony party to speak on the show at some point.
Oh, I'd actually love that.
Should we try? Sorry for the future.
Yes.
But Andrew Neil is not interviewing the loonies. Depending on your point of view, he's interviewing Jeremy Corbyn from the Labour Party, and he's interviewed Theresa May from the Tories. And it's widely agreed that Theresa May's interview did not go very well for her, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I was just really bored. I watched a compilation where every time she says the word strong or stable, it speeds up. which looked like an anxiety nightmare. we'll talk about that. Also, the fact that Labour have had a particularly favourable poll out of the Times. who have had a surge to 38%, only 5 points behind the Conservatives. The pound has actually dropped because of the prospect of a hung parliament, which Jimmy is wringing his hands in glee about because, oh, wouldn't it be interesting?
I have a slightly psychotic tendency where I just basically want chaos to engulf things because I think it'll make for interesting news, but...
Just chaotic neutral journalist.
Yeah, I think so.
We should say that that particular, it is an outlying poll, and it does show an extreme to what has been a general trend in polling of the Conservatives going down, and the Tories, other Conservatives going down, the Labour Party going up, since the release of the manifestos.
Yeah,
And we'll also be talking about the campaign in general since the break from Manchester. Then finally,
I think this is Rowan's favourite topic.
Maybe.
We'll see.
Katie Hopkins said that we should find a final solution to Islam and then lost her job at the national radio station LBC. We'll be talking about that and the implications for free speech.
Fun stuff all around.
Excellent. Good. So, an Ariana Grande concert last week, as people and patrons were leaving the venue, a man decided to blow himself up with a bomb that had nuts and bolts in it, killing 20-something...
22 people.
22 people.
And injuring, what, 70 odd more?
Something like that. One of the... certainly the biggest terrorist attack of this this decade... And also particularly interesting because it's one of the first ones we've had in a while that has seemed to use these kinds of methods that require an awful lot of organising, such as like even the building of bombs is quite hard to organise at the moment because of examples like in the 7/7 bombings, one of the perpetrators actually ended up having bleached blonde hair because of the amount of peroxide that is used in the making of bombs. People often, when they're practicing this kind of stuff, end up accidentally blowing themselves up. But this was a scary and coordinated attack, and we'd only really seen kind of small scale, almost desperate looking examples of terrorism with the Westminster attack.
It contrasts very
starkly
with the Westminster attack.
And also the murder of Lee Rigby, the soldier, earlier in this decade.
This attack was 4 years after the murder of Lee Rigby?
Yes.
It was actually on the anniversary of it. So.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Nice to know that they've got a Google calendar for that kind of stuff. What did you... do you think that this type of attack gives us anything particular to worry about? Do you think anything has changed? Or, like many of the politicians and the experts, do you think that we just have to accept that this kind of stuff is going to continue to... like, stuff is going to slip through the cracks every now and again?
Yeah, I mean, the London mayor, Sadiq Khan, is often criticised by certain people for saying that terrorism is part of living in a big Western city now, but it is true, basically. And... I don't... These sort of attacks always prompt a kind of existential crisis within Britain, particularly around issues of migration and that sort of thing. And really, it's just a crime problem, I think. There are foreign policy issues that are related to it, but in terms of...
As, like, the instigator way up the flow, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously types of crime where it's a type of crime with foreign policy implications, but where, in terms of how you actually deal with it on a basic level, it is just a crime, fundamentally. And I think the evidence is that we have got better with in terms of things like the Prevent programme and in terms of how the security services deal with this sort of thing. But you know, it's just a shame that every single time it does happen, people do go a bit mental about the whole thing. Understandably, but you know, it's not necessarily helpful.
There are some people who are suggesting that this was specifically a misogynistic attack because of the fact that they targeted an Ariana Grande concert, because of the fact that they a lot of the people who ended up dying were especially young women who were going out and having a good time. Interestingly, contrasting this with the Orlando attack where a lot of LGBT people died at the Pulse nightclub. That I kind of agreed with the fact that that was a homophobic attack, mm-hmm. Because the people were specifically targeted because of the fact that they were LGBT. And I, like Owen Jones, was really frustrated with the fact that people were saying, like, oh no, this is just an attack on Western mm-hmm. ideals in general. Mm. I've had a big think about this, and I've struggled to see it as specifically a misogynistic attack. I think as a periphery it is. But I'm not sure if that was necessarily the intent. What do you think, Rowan?
So
help me understand.
So I think that the one of the reasons why we can pinpoint Orlando and the homophobia within that is the nature of the planning of the attack, mm-hmm. right? So the plan to just go pick a venue and go in with a gun is very different to planning on when you're going to be in the country, planning on a bomb, planning on getting through security, all of those kind of things. I feel like it was... with a gun in America, sadly, you can pretty much go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So for me, it is not something that right now can be said either way. I would need to make up my own mind about that. I would need to look at, was this could only be this particular day? Mm-hmm. Was this had to be within this time frame, and this was just the one where there were most people going to it? Was it something, you know, there are so many variables of how in order to orchestrate this attack successfully had to be made, so that it might have been a complete coincidence or it might not have been. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it was... I do feel like there is an argument to be made if it was... there were a number of concerts or events that could have been targeted in this one specifically. Because mm-hmm. her fan base is young girls and gay people. Like, yeah. that is her fan base.
And those were the majority. And it was young girls...
and families.
LGBT
as well.
People and their parents.
Yeah.
That ended up being the victims of this attack.
Surely if you went through the rigmarole of planning the bombing and having to create the bomb, coordinate all of that, you would pick a specific time and date as
but
your
that's what I'm saying,
point of attack.
Is that I don't know, right? So I don't know which way round it is easiest to do, because I've never planned a bomb anywhere. whether there were particular things around this is a venue that we've chosen for this particular reason, or whether it's... Do you know what I mean? Like, there's, like, it may well be that actually you're completely right, and it was, they could pick a date, and then everything else, they could orchestrate around that date, or it might be something else. But I feel like I don't have enough information around the planning of it to be able to say either way. Mm-hmm. And we did actually, so obviously working at the pool, we talk about women's stuff a lot, and this was something that had been brought up, and we talked about it a lot. And one of our writers was like, I'm not happy with just speculating at this point. Mm. So talk to three different experts in things like terrorism, public and international relations, and basically put to them, is this possible? Is this something that you think might have been a cause? And all three of them were like, no. Mm-hmm. It was potentially part, but it was not
part
a deciding factor yeah. within it, or at least we definitely can't say that it is right now.
There was a lot of criticism of the Manchester Arena because there seemed to be a lack of security and a lack of bag checks going into the venue. Also, because this happened when everybody was leaving, it tends to be more lack security as people are leaving a venue and fewer checks of people actually entering it. Although, like, at the end of the day, the speculations of all of that kind of stuff, I don't think is hugely helpful. Mm. There was an awful lot of... for me, this... I used to live around the corner from the MEN. And, like, for me, especially as somebody who lived in Manchester, I was really moved to see all of the kind of, like, Unity stuff, people giving up their homes, taking people home in their cabs for free and all that kind of stuff. But there is a cohort of people who tend to be... right-leaning, Katie Hopkins included, who we're going to be talking about in more depth later on, who seem frustrated by the message of togetherness and hope and solidarity. Can either of you really explain that at all?
Her point of view.
Yeah, like, why are they? Do they seem so irritated by the fact that the major kind of, like, feeling that comes out of this tends to be one of, we will not be cowed, we... will be, we will like stand up and be together. Because we had heard her saying the same thing after the Westminster attack as well on Fox News.
Yeah, she went over and said, actually, London is, you know, divided and scared and whatever. I think whenever something like this happens, there is a lot of just mawkish crap that people spout. For good reasons, but when you listen to what they say and you try and process it in a sensible way, a lot of it doesn't really make any sense. It's the sort of words that are said at funerals that are nice things to say, but are meaningless in terms of content. So I guess I do agree with her in as much as that is the case. And actually, the way of dealing with problems with this is to talk about dealing with problems, but then there's the whole psychological thing of, you know, people need to grieve and people need to come to terms with it in their own way. And one of the ways they do that is by, you know, offering free travels if you're a cab driver and that sort of thing, and just, you know, showing acts of kindness and that that sort of thing. But yeah, I know what people mean. It is when you actually sort of read all of the nice words that are spoken and you think, this isn't really how we're going to deal with this problem. We're going to deal with this problem in practical ways, not just by spouting some gumph that doesn't really mean anything. So,
I do. Okay, so I think that people like Katie Hopkins, or at least who have the opinions that she presents publicly, already have an idea of like an us versus them. Before the attack happens, it's like, this is us, this is them. And so for them, this attack is a kind of a bolstering of their views. And so when afterwards people don't suddenly come around to their point of view, because they're like, how obvious is it? This is demonstrated that I was right about the us versus them, because they have done this thing to us. And when they then see a load of people being like, everyone should come together, I can understand how from their point of view it's like, why are you so blind? Why can't you see what I can see? And I think it's however much I completely disagree with what she thinks, I can completely understand how it's after an attack like this that people with that point of view become even more frustrated that the rest of the public isn't coming over to their side, changing their minds and say, and like waking up as it were, and saying, yes, this is, you were right the whole time. But I do think it's there is something in this idea of like, words and saying things and just saying things that maybe has some more power within a context of terrorism that is about ideals. So like it becomes like a weaponized kindness to say, in the face of these people who are specifically targeting our lifestyle or ideas or ideals, for us to keep those ideas and ideals becomes something that's slightly more powerful than it might be if you were just at someone's funeral being like, oh, they were such a good person and let's go on with kindness and love to him. Like, it, for me, there's like slightly more to it. It's not everything.
Yeah,
and obviously practical steps need to be taken, but I can understand how it can be more powerful than in other circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a thing of just a general phenomenon among columnists and commentators where whatever event happens, they just push it into what they've already been saying. So, I mean, you see it around general elections, particularly, like, whichever way the result goes, a columnist will say, oh, these opinions that I have had already are the explanation for why the result went this way. That's just how people work.
This is nothing new, really, but one of the things that particularly, like, hit me was the age of the people, of the man who who did the attack.
He carried
out the
attack. Yeah.
Thank you for the actual words.
Linguistic
that
things.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah. his brother was also arrested. He was only 24. Three men were arrested between the ages of 18 and 24. A 22-year-old, and then a couple of people in their 30s. I don't know what it is about the age of the people that shocked me so much this time, but it kind of brought in the realization of kind of like the PREVENT program, which is specifically meant to kind of combat and tackle extremism in younger communities, especially at universities, colleges, schools and mosques. There has been a huge amount of pushback from that, from educational institutions in general. So when you're going around a lot of universities, you will see posters that say, we say no to PREVENT. All those kinds of things. Do you think that because a lot of the people who end up giving up their lives for this kind of extremism, they are so young and are going to be in those spaces, do you think that we perhaps need to embrace the Prevent program more.
Why do people not like it? Is it because they don't think it's working well enough? Or because they just disagree completely?
Because it targets people based on their ethnicity, religion, and background.
They also feel that it is perhaps divisive and that it's not effective, but I think the evidence is that it has had a positive impact on the whole. So, but you know. I think it's more like an ideological thing that you shouldn't target specific minority groups because they feel it's like scapegoating and labelling and that sort of thing. I think that's the angle to which they're coming at it from.
Do you think that they have they are right to be questioning it in that way, or do you think that
it's similar to the argument about
danger of alienating young people from like Middle Eastern and Muslim backgrounds because of just the existence of the Prevent?
There's definitely a danger of doing that, but if the net effect is positive, then I don't really see what the problem is. You know, there's very few perfect solutions that don't have any downsides to them when it comes to fighting crime and or really any policy area. So their criticisms are probably valid, but if the net effect is good, then, you know, it seems like a sensible programme to me.
I have one final question for you. Do you believe that this was commented on by Jeremy Corbyn, who we're going to go on to in a couple of minutes, and he was widely slated by the mainstream media, for saying that people have turned to extremism because of the UK's foreign policy. Is there any truth in that?
Well, he cited two MI5, former heads of MI5, who've said similar things.
Which is our version of the FBI for any American.
It's the Home Security Service. But, it must be a factor, right? Like, especially because the groups like Islamic State are using it as a means of propagating their views. They're saying, look at the West, they're attacking Muslim countries, they're out to get us. So it would seem incredible if the foreign interventions, the foreign wars that Britain and the US have carried out have not had an impact in that sense.
And also created the power vacuums that exist, which Corbyn talks about an awful lot. But I think that is a very difficult, because it's complicated geopolitics and history, and that is a very difficult thing to get the majority of the British public to understand properly.
It just baffles me that this has been blown up as some kind of controversial statement. Like, it's been this big sticking point. Like, it was in the interviews that we're going to talk about, the idea of, how could you say this? This is so... Because I think the interpretation does become, so you're saying it's our fault. So you're, like, blaming us for what happened. As opposed to, like, no, this is definitely a factor in what's going on and we have to... It's strange, right? Because people want to be able to say we can prevent terrorism, but then they don't want to say that we had anything to do with it in the first place. And I think in order for you to say there are things that we can do to prevent it, you have to acknowledge that there are things that we're doing which are contributing to it in the first place, in order for us to help stop it. I think like it's borne out throughout history, right? It's like it's not rocket science to suggest that when you disenfranchise people, or when you attack people, or even if you do it and people are able to take that and feed it into young people's ears or anyone's ears and say, this is what they're doing to you, it's us versus them, you know, feeding this idea, that terrorism or some version of it comes from that. Like, who do people think ISIS are? That ISIS aren't like born ISIS and they're the ISIS people. Like, like that's ridiculous. Like, everyone is born and is shaped by the factors that surround them and are shaped by the rhetoric around them, shaped by the politics around them, shaped by the geography around them. And so people are not joining ISIS from, like, they're shooting out of the vagina and, like, going straight into the ranks. Like, that's not how it works.
Or caesarean.
Yeah, or caesarean, that's just shooting out of the caesarean.
I don't think you guys understand how caesarean is.
that's not how it happens. People are influenced, and there are many, many, many factors that are going to influence that. And so to say that we've, like, nothing that we've done in creating any power vacuums or in bombing people or anything like that is what's going on. And it's actually all about our lifestyle and our values. And all we had to do was be this liberal Western country and then they hated us is, like, ridiculously naive to me. I just find it really strange that people are even making this into a big, like, Corbyn loves terrorists thing to do with it. Like, it just, it baffles me.
Shall we move on to those interviews that took place this week? There was a pause in campaigning.
Yes.
After the Manchester bomb for about 3 days. And so there was a delay between Theresa May's first interview, which was on Monday, and Corbyn's, which eventually ended up being aired on Friday. You're a fan of Andrew Neil.
I am.
He is a man of broadcasting calibre.
And broader body as well. He's a fatso, basically.
So many other things you can critique him for.
I think you're going to do that. So.
I was under the impression that these... I think that Andrew Neil is a bit too old school in the way that he conducts interviews. I don't think that there's anything fresh or exciting on it, and I don't think that viewers particularly get an awful lot of information out of the types of interviews that he does, in that he will ask the same question again and again and again, and they will be able to give the set response again and again and again. I told you before we started recording that I think it's a lot of heat and not a lot of light. Yes. And I was really frustrated by the interviews. And I think that the only way of getting beyond that is by having them do a head-to-head debate.
I disagree. I think head-to-head debates and even those town halls that they held at the last election, where a single candidate goes before a crowd and the crowd asks them questions, I think both of those don't really provide any informational value.
Mm-hmm. What new information did you get out of these interviews with Andrew Neil?
Not very much new information, because actually Corbyn and Theresa May have been asked a lot of those questions before. Mm-hmm. But
they were now all under one roof.
Yeah, I think if the only way that people are going to engage with the election is by watching these interviews, they were comprehensive, or they were informative in the topics that they covered. In the case of Corbyn, it was mostly foreign policy, because the interview happened after the Manchester attacks. And with Theresa May, it was more about her manifesto U-turn and mm-hmm. her track record.
And how she's not strong and stable, but wibbly and wobbly.
I think it's necessary to keep asking someone the same question. I realise why audiences find that frustrating, but it's very easy for a politician to dodge a question if you don't ask it to them several times.
Mm-hmm. But did they not just dodge the questions in those interviews?
They did, but if someone's dodged a question three times, it's a lot more obvious that they had no intention of answering it. I think it clarifies their position if they're not willing to answer it.
I think that I wish that that was true, but then my impression that I got from the interviews, or at least how people are going to receive them, is that people are going to interpret them how they want to interpret them.
Mm.
So if you are a supporter of the candidate and the candidate refuses to answer, you can say that candidate was being strong in their answer, they were sticking to their guns, they shouldn't have to answer that question in that way, you know, that's ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. And if you disagree, you can say, that's a wishy-washy, answer the bloody question, like, and so I do think it is that thing of having, like, two personalities who are facing off against each other, in a way, even if it's kind of separately, and having a lot of the stuff talked about being these, the big things that have been blown up, like that the media have picked up on and said, this is what's important. I think it's interesting because it says, like, okay, people have seen these in the news maybe, or kind of heard about them. Let's see the questions put directly to them. But I don't know how actually informative that is around getting to the bottom of, okay, but what actually are your policies, or what are you actually going to be doing? It was more like, you've been accused of this. Mm-hmm. Defend yourself from me, which maybe to me wasn't that, like, useful.
I think if you just ask them to lay out their broad manifesto things, it would be even more tedious and even less informative.
I mean, yeah, and they exist, and they're... Yeah,
if you
get them in paperback.
Yeah, if you really want to read the Tory or the Labour manifestos, you can just do that on the internet. Most people won't.
Yeah, but that's my point. Most people won't, but these interviews are being televised. These interviews were, like, hugely, hugely, like, ramped up and hyped up, and people were going to watch them. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was an opportunity. There was an opportunity to do a mix of things, whereas what it turned into was only, here are some things you have been accused of, defend yourself. Oh, okay, defend yourself. Okay, I'm going to move on because you didn't defend yourself.
I think the media does need to select what issues are most important given election. You can't go for everything.
There was one example of that, especially with Jeremy Corbyn, when Andrew Neil just kept on asking him, what do you think about Trident? He's like, I've made it really clear and I voted against Trident, but the Labour Party has decided that it will continue to back
but
Trident.
The weird thing about,
and then he kept on having
the weird
to
thing
answer
is
that again and
Corbyn
again.
Won't actually answer those questions directly. He'll answer them indirectly. So he would, like, when he's asked about the IRA, for instance, mm-hmm. like, do you condemn the IRA bombings? He'll say, oh, I condemn all the bombings. And this was the Sophie Ridgeon's feed rather than the Neil one. But she kept asking him, and he kept refusing to answer. And it was obvious that he was not going to condemn the IRA bombings without equivocating about it. So you do actually find out information, but you do it because he won't answer a particular question.
But I think with the Trident thing, he did very clearly answer the question.
No, he didn't say, look, I disagree with Trident and my party has ridden over me on this one.
That is essentially what he said.
He said, my views have been very clear on this.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't like a yes on the thing. You've seen my vote.
But he did say,
which is essentially the same thing, but not. It was just what was really strange to me in both his interviews was how political it was and how Theresa May kept being like, you can play. He wants to play politics with it, and I'm like, you're both. That's
you literally
job,
just
mate.
Called
like,
a general like, election
because there were these ideas that clearly someone has coached and said, okay, we cannot give them the soundbite of you saying this in a sentence, or you can't say this just in case you want to change your mind. We want to like change it depending on public opinion, whatever. And it was just to me, it became very transparent about how transparent that was in both of the interviews, and I don't really know in terms of what the purpose of the interviews are. Yeah, like, what are the purpose of them? Like, what was it trying to expose? What was it trying to get
show? It's like a marketing thing, basically, is that when you interview someone about something, they just want to talk about the positive aspects of what they're pitching, and the journalist wants to ask them about the negative aspects, and they want to ask them difficult questions and see how they respond. And I do think the Andrew Neil interviews did do that, basically.
You said that you thought Theresa May's went particularly badly. Why do you think that?
I think because she's a liar. I'm sort of like labouring this particular phrase, but she's a Trumpian liar in the sense that she tells a lie to camera that is so easily verifiably false. It's not even something that she's fudging. It's not something that she's kind of like being ambiguous about. She's just lying. She's outright lying, and everyone knows that she's lying. And it just. I think the last.
Have you got an example of that from the interview?
Oh, yeah, the fact that she said that she hadn't changed the policy on capping the costs for social care, which it was just obviously a lie. Everyone. I mean, I watched the there was a Gogglebox clip of like the various families watching that clip, and they were like, "Yeah, she's lying." And as a politician, it's okay to mislead people. It's not okay just to lie straight to their faces.
Why is she so against saying, yeah, we made a mistake, we've decided not to do that?
I think because she thinks it will make her look weak, but the irony of that is that she looks very, very weak at the moment. And it's the interview process has also clarified that she is not very charismatic and she's not very fleet of mind when it comes to dealing with
these things.
She's
a fantastic concept. When she first came in, she was like the head teacher, the woman that's going to come in and sort everything out, as often happens in British politics. Everything goes to shit and then the lady swans in and goes, calm down, everybody. She has like the whole strong, stable leadership, that bloody difficult woman that she's reclaimed. She has a fantastic concept and brand behind her. But then in terms of her public delivery, she isn't brilliant. And I think that the only way that she's really gotten away with it is because the most of the times that we've seen her be political have been at stuff like PMQs, where she's been against somebody who is even worse than her in the form of Jeremy Corbyn.
I think that the lack of a competitive leadership contest for the Tories.
Yeah, as well.
It's
she
one of
was
the reasons
just
she's
anointed.
Got away with it. I think if she had to go up against Boris Johnson, who hadn't been stabbed in the back by Michael Gove, she'd have had a far more difficult time of it.
What did you think of the Corbyn interview? Do you think his went better than hers?
It seemed to me that he was far more composed in his answers. He didn't look overly ruffled by the
grilling.
There
were a couple of times when
he
was like, if you'd let me answer the bloody sentence.
Yeah.
Or finish the bloody sentence, Andrew.
Yeah. I thought
that's also why I don't like him. He's just bloody rude.
Well, that's the point of journalists. They're supposed to be rude.
Is it? Or can you charm it out of them?
You can charm it out of them sometimes, but not usually with politicians. But yeah, I mean, I thought he was quite composed. What were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think so as well. I just think as well they have two very different vibes. Like, you are right, there's this kind of very politician, which was what was such a joke about her, kept talking about
how he's
playing politics. And I'm like, you could not be more of a politician. Like, in terms of, like, that idea of, like, the statesman type idea of being weirdly removed from the people in a strange way. But I think that's always kind of been the vibe, right? Like, that's, Corbyn has always had this kind of idea of, like, being with the people and be, you know, like, in the mess of things and everything. And so the conversation with Corbyn, to me, felt more like a conversation than it did... here is what I'm going to say. This is what I'm going to say in a very, like, with the politician hand movements going on. And, like, but whether or not people respond to that will be different, right? Because some people will say, actually, that's strong and stable. We need a leader. We need a politician. This is who we need. And then other people will say, I'd much rather have someone that I trust. And it's kind of interesting because I think that that's not necessarily down party lines, because you see with, like, someone like Nigel Farage that... you can have someone who is that casual everyman down the pub, and he's really successful for some people. So it's not necessarily like a really cut and dry, like, oh yes, Conservative voters will appeal to them because she's like this, and Labour voters will appeal because she's like this. So I don't know how far that's successful within the brand of their parties, as it were, or whether it's just a personal thing. But yeah, I think it's kind of an interesting difference between them that became very obvious when contrasting the two together with the same interviewer, kind of same environment.
I think Corbyn has a far more toxic brand, as it were, as in his general weakness on foreign policy, which is one of the reasons why the Tories were trying to attack him for what he said about, you know, foreign interventions affecting terrorism in the UK, is that he has aligned himself frequently with anti-British forces throughout, since he's been a politician, basically.
Including the IRA.
The IRA. I think the Falkland Islands is probably the weirdest one for him, but he's consistently backed the Argentines, even though...
No, so what he's done is he wants to open up dialogue with them, and perhaps...
He has suggested a power-sharing arrangement, which, given the sentiment on the actual Falkland Islands, is crazy.
And the fact that we have a population there.
Yeah, and I think that kind of just speaks to a general tendency that he has to basically back the non-US, non-UK forces throughout any global conflict. And that's why people interpret certain things he says in that way that you pointed out earlier.
We mentioned the flip-flop on the policy, or the wibbly-wobbly response to the policy that Theresa May had about the cap on the amount of money that is going to be taken out of pensioners' houses if they're going to care.
Yeah.
Is essentially what it is. Very complicated. And I'm really annoyed that this hasn't been explained more often and more frequently.
I have to say that even though I understand it's a U-turn, I don't really understand the policy itself. I don't think it's been fully explained at this point.
So we can't go into detail, but essentially... there is a crisis in the funding and the organisation of care with the NHS and in the UK at the moment. The way that Theresa May and the Conservatives have suggested funding it is by taking money out of people's homes. And that, I believe, was going to be indefinite, but now they will only take up to the point where your house is...
I thought it was up to £100,000worth
of assets. Or up to £100,000? It would have basically stolen money from Graham, which is very nasty. And this has widely been seen as the thing that has caused the drop in Theresa May's polling, so much to an extent that people are talking about the prospect of a hung parliament, and even like her getting nowhere near the amount of votes that were expected.
The poll itself, the YouGov Times poll that put the Tories and Labour so close, gave Theresa May a majority of two, if you actually sort of pared it down to seats.
Interestingly, so I'm always really aware of that because they're done by popular vote, and actually we don't have popular vote.
I think they try to account for the constituencies.
But very rarely very...
Well, it's just a guess.
Yeah. Good. Well, that's all I want people to understand, Jim.
Yeah. The polls are also a guess.
Was meant to be the Brexit election, right? And actually it's ended up being the election about really boring... domestic policy, and the whole thing about Labour being the ones that want to spend and care, and the Tories being the one that want to slash and destroy. Are you surprised that it's a policy about like care that seems to be nibbling at Theresa May's feet?
Not surprised at all.
Well, a lot of the Tory papers latched onto it, and their readership is infamously grey. Mm-hmm. and this is
as in old, not boy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but you know, if you do something that pisses off the reader base of like the Telegraph or the Express or the Mail, you have to do that with serious care, I think, because they, the newspapers know what their readership likes and they will go out and campaign against that sort of thing. So it was very foolish in that sense. But actually, I don't really think it was a crazy idea to, you know, make up for the shortfall in funding on social care by, you know, essentially taking money from people who have a lot of assets.
We were talking about last week the policies of the Conservative Manifesto, one of them also being an attack, not so much an attack, I think that old people should actually be taxed a little bit more, an attack on old people with the means testing for the winter fuel allowance. We saw this in the Andrew Neil interview, that she refused to say what the criteria are going to look like, and she's like, oh, we haven't decided yet. We know broadly that the people at the very bottom are going to still keep it, and the people at the very top are not going to have the £300 or so a year to go towards their winter fuel allowance. But there's a huge section in the middle who have no idea whether or not they're going to be £300 worse off a year. We were talking about the fact that she was incredibly confident about the majority that she was going to get, and so was offering up, was proposing policies that were going to damage her core voters, but she thought that it was going to be fine. Has she basically shot herself in the foot?
Yeah, I think that's the only interpretation. I still think she's going to get a fairly decent majority at the end of the day, but it's not been a good week for her, let's say.
Bless her cotton socks.
Yeah,
I think I'd agree with that.
There's a really... I love a hypothetical scenario, and I can't remember who it was. I retweeted them, and there was a great thread about what hypothetically happens when Theresa May potentially... I'm not sure this is going to happen, but when she potentially gets a very, very slim majority or has to form a minority government, she then resigns. Boris Johnson then becomes the Prime Minister.
Why is it in these scenarios Boris Johnson always ends up as Prime Minister?
He just, like, swings in. I'm like...
Is this going to be the next 20 years every time there's a, you know, a major crisis of Tory leadership?
It's like, so when is he going to be the Prime Minister? It just kind of submits the fact that it's probably going to happen at some point. Boris Johnson becomes the Prime Minister as the one of the lead Brexiters is able to sell a soft Brexit, or even perish the thought us not leaving the EU.
He won't do that. This is a very implausible scenario from the offset.
But it's the chaos that you've always wanted, Jimmy.
I do think it would be quite funny if Labour won the election and then basically decided not to do Brexit properly. Even as someone who voted Leave, that it's just, you know, that's just amusing.
So
it?
Much fun. Yeah.
It was just like, Brexit was just a fever dream, nation. It's everything's the same. Don't worry about
it. Would have been. Oh, if only. Katie Hopkins, friend of the podcast.
She's not a friend of the podcast.
She met me once. I met her once. I should probably put it.
She met me once.
She was honoured to do so. She lost her job at LBC because she suggested a final solution to Islam.
It sounded quite a lot like she was suggesting we round up all the Muslims in the country and kill
them.
That was the inference from the tweet.
I think that she just chose her words very poorly. I'm not sure she necessarily meant that. Do you think so?
I don't think that Kate Hopkins...
See, I've met her and I think she's lovely.
I don't think Kate Hopkins actually wants to carry out a genocide on British Muslims, but I do think that she used the phrase final solution deliberately to piss people off.
That's
what she's like.
Then has ended up losing her job at the second largest talk radio station in the UK.
Apparently LBC's staff clapped when the news was released.
Oh yeah, I know some people in the building, and she's not liked very much. Although the thing is, they have a considerable number of right-leaning presenters on
Ian Dale,
Ian Dale, Nick Ferrari.
But I think there's a difference between right-wing or right-leaning and Katie Hopkins as well.
A lot of people were decrying Jimmy. I saw you vaguely tweeting about this, decrying the fact that this was an attack on her freedom of speech.
No, I wasn't decrying that. I was basically, whenever somebody's fired or deplatformed or whatever, some progressive will always say free speech doesn't protect you from the consequences of speech, and actually, free speech laws do protect you from many of the consequences of free speech.
Yeah, but it doesn't guarantee you a paid job, say, and stuff.
No, I'd agree with that, but. I don't really think that people should necessarily celebrate people essentially losing their jobs because of their views. And I think, in general...
Would you have kept her on? Do you think that this was fair?
Well, one thing...
You did just say that she basically supported genocide of Muslim people.
No. I think she tweeted...
Rowan has collapsed.
I think she tweeted deliberately to antagonise people. I don't think she supports genocide of British mm-hmm. Muslims,
yeah,
is what I said.
Considering how we've seen a rise in hate crime, how we've seen a rise in violence against minorities... Can you see how that would it's not just a harmless thing to tweet a bit of like fun for her personality, and everyone would just look at it and be like, oh, Katie Hopkins, like there are going to be
Katie,
some people,
what are you like?
There are going to be some people who take it very, very seriously. There are some people who are absolutely agreeing with her, and for her to be in a position of power and paid to be in that position of power to show, to express those views and to start to stir up this sentiment is a little bit more than just being like, oh, this is what I think.
I don't think anyone. Well, I mean, the sort of people who would be influenced by a tweet like that are probably very Islamophobic generally, and are probably inclined to actually behave badly towards Muslims anyway.
That's a way of putting it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's broad, isn't it?
Stick out your tongue at them.
I don't really agree with the logic of hate speech criminalisation, which I think is what you're gesturing at.
I'm saying is, if you're going to say that this is, you know... That people's views, like, it's fine, they have these views, this is her views, and she can say her views, and then you don't like the idea of people being fired because of their views. Can you see where there is a line? When like, this is not something that just, like, people say things and there are no consequences to them, to other people. I'm not saying
it's
you
very,
say something,
it's
we
very,
punish
it's
you.
It's very
I'm
difficult
saying,
to pin down the consequences, really. It's kind of just, you know, it's an assertion that can't really be backed up or disproved one way or the other when you say that there are consequences to speech. It's just, you know, it's kind of a general point. And you can't really punish people for... an abstraction like that.
Do you think that should have lost her job?
Well, my point would be that LBC was quite happy...
No, don't do a Corbyn on me.
No. What I'm going to do is I'm going to answer it broadly and then answer you specifically,
okay,
which is what I do every fucking week when you ask me a question like this, is that LBC was very happy to keep her on... to hire her in the first place, despite LBC hired her after she said her infamous cockroaches quote, referring to
refugees from Syria.
Yes, well, also Africans migrating across the Mediterranean, I think it was. But she said that, and LBC were quite happy to hire her on the basis of that. But as soon as she mentions the Holocaust, she's suddenly been fired. Mm. I don't think LBC really come out very well out of this whole thing, because I don't think that the final solution quote was any worse than her cockroaches quote.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really see why they've decided...
Or the fact that she also... Something else that she tweeted on the day, she said that... Because there was another bomb scare in Manchester shortly after the one at the arena. And she said, oh, what is it? Ramadan starting early. And I'm like...
But she's been offensive for a very, very long time, and it's not obvious to me why this particular quote...
Do you think it was because it echoes the Holocaust?
Yeah, I think so. I think once you... That's just a psychological point in Western thought where you... I mean, we're all familiar with the Ken Livingstone debacle, right? And it's just a topic...
He was the mayor of London for 8 years.
Yeah.
But I think that it's like... that. It wasn't like everyone just suddenly went... Oh God, Katie Hopkins is a bit of a dick, isn't she?
Yeah.
Like, I think that was just purely, like you said, just LBC's like kind of policy line, as it were. Whether or not it was policy, but you know what I mean. It was like the company being like, okay, this is
much.
Is it. But I don't think anyone in the public was like, she's been totally fine up until now, but this is the one
this
thing.
Is very out of character.
Like, I think
for her.
That everyone already who already wanted her gone, and everyone who didn't really care about her still probably doesn't really care because of her saying that.
Yeah, I mean, she'll probably get another job for, I don't know, some American broadcast.
Find it quite funny.
Yeah.
A lot of people have been suggesting that. And she also, after she lost her job, quite quickly started tweeting at Reply Fox News. about that. I can't wait to be on Fox News later on, because she was like a guest on a show or something.
Yeah.
So, yay, fun there.
I mean, she is an embarrassment, but if LBC thinks that it you know, should provide a platform for a diverse set of views... Presumably Katie Hopkins should be part of that remit.
Yeah, but, like, hardcore Islamophobia. Like, I'm all for people like Ian Dale and Nick Ferrari and even Nigel Farage. having shows on LBC, and they have a broad spectrum from James O'Brien all the way to Nigel Farage, and I'm totally okay with that. But I think that Katie Hopkins, and I don't think that she actually believes half the stuff, because she met me, and she actually seems like a half decent human being, and she's doing this for her career.
I think a lot of people with, you know, extreme views of one sort or another are quite genial when you meet them in person. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's exclusive to her. I just think,
but she was nice, so she can't be bad.
If there is a good reason to fire Katie Hopkins, it's because that her content is so valueless, really. It is just winding people up for the sake of it, and there is no real payoff.
You know? There was one thing. She went to camps in Calais, I think last year, and ended up being brought to tears by the circumstances that a lot of children were in there. And I, like, perhaps we could chip away at her and turn her into a good person.
But I reckon she'd still do that. But the thing is, I reckon that she'd still do that as a publicity thing, so I reckon that that would be... If this is something that she's doing for publicity, and I think that there's... It kind of seems like it, then that will be an opportunity for her to do a big rebrand and for it to be like the sort of Saul on the road to Damascus thing, where she's like, I've been completely good, this is blah blah blah, and then just turn herself around. And
like Rush Limbaugh in the US is now like a hipster left wing like vapor.
Is it?
Yeah. Is it Rush Limbaugh? I think it's Rush Limbaugh. One of the right wing jocks has been like, I made a huge mistake. Look at the world I've created.
Mm-hmm.
People tend not to move from right to left, though. Like, the big conversions in, like, in the British media at least, are like Melanie Phillips, used to write for The Guardian, now is, you know, sort of reactionary crank, basically.
Is it Rush Limbaugh? I don't know. Maybe it's not. It's somebody else. Glenn Beck.
Did you just make this up?
Yeah, it's Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck is now like a born again liberal.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What? But I do like, okay, because I do think that the idea of people, I do think that there is this like that the whole sort of like, what the fuck is it called? On the internet, like, you can't make a mistake because people will completely destroy you, and if they find something you did 6 years ago on Tumblr, they're going to be like, this is it, like, no forgiveness, whatever. And I think that is super dangerous. Like, I think that is extremely dangerous. I think that there's always that people can change their minds, absolutely, because otherwise, like, how do we think people come up with their minds in the first place? But people should have consequences. Like, there should be consequences for, like, Not in terms of, like, there must be consequences, I'm going to put these in law, but I think that there's inevitably, if you say something to people, don't be surprised if people say stuff back. Don't be surprised if something comes back at you. But I don't think that you saying this thing once should mean that you're always going to say this, and you feel pressured to always say this, and people will reject you if you then say something different and try it like that. And I think that that increasingly is like a thing that people are... Not even increasingly, I just think it's more publicised that people are saying, you know, you say this one thing wrong, and instead of using it as an opportunity for dialogue, it's like, nope, that's it, you've done your one thing wrong, you're in the corner with the rest of them. Because no one's perfect, no one is 100% says perfect things all of the time, and no one was born believe, like, as I said before, everyone's a product of their circumstances. And so I would love to see a world in which Katie Hopkins becomes someone who doesn't try, like, have this kind of weird encouraging of, like, dehumanisation, but it's not like someone's responsibility to try and do that.
That is very interesting, because like, as we see young people using online networks, we see fewer and fewer of them using stuff that is largely public, like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube.
No, it's
we
more about controlling more of them using, the environment.
Something we social scientists call scalable sociality.
We social scientists.
I'm a fucking social scientist. Leave me alone. It's the fluffiest of all the sciences. And we see a lot of them choosing not to have those public profiles. Whereas we're, I think, in the middle generation where it was normal and it was okay to do that. But there does seem to be a shift away from that. Rowan, where can people... This is the end, by the way.
That was sweet.
This is the end. Goodbye. No. Rowan, where can people find you if they particularly want to cheer you on in life?
Thanks, hypothetical audience.
We're having a 1,000-strong hypothetical audience.
If you want to find me on Twitter, then I'm Hey Rowan Ellis there. And if you want to find me on YouTube, just search for Rowan Ellis, and it's me. And I think the bodybuilder, but it's quite obvious which one's me and which one's him. So that's all you have to do.
Excellent. Just make sure you have restricted mode turned off. Sick burn. Jimmy, where can people find you?
At JDE Nichols on
and
Twitter.
And nowhere else. And I can be found at Jazza John and across the interwebs. If you type in Jazza for me, it's me and this Australian drawing YouTuber who has youtube.com/Jazza, and I want to burn him. It's not even his real fucking name. His name is Josiah.
It's not really a real name, is it?
28 years of this. Happy podcast. Find us at Right Dishonor. Like us. No, star us if you're on iTunes. Like us everywhere else. Tweet us on the end.
Beautiful.